Welcome to KABU, Giuliani Hauschultz.
Hello, thanks for the invitation.
Well, you are active in the German section of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, and you're a campaigner for nuclear disarmament at the German section of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW. So we are so delighted to have you join us today to talk about the second meeting of states parties at the United Nations during the end of November through December 1st, where you were an attendee. First, can you set the stage for us? What was the scene and what was the significance of this international meeting, the first of which was held in 2022?
Of course. So the second meeting of states parties of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, so it's a real long name. And this conference that was just held in New York City is at the moment, I would say, the only forum where nuclear disarmament is discussed internationally, because this treaty is the first treaty that bans nuclear weapons internationally. It is only legally binding to its member states, but that's why these member states meet at these conferences to discuss how exactly they want to achieve nuclear disarmament and how they want to achieve all the obligations, the negative and the positive obligations of this treaty. The treaty forbids all kinds of activities around nuclear weapons. So, of course, to deploy nuclear weapons, but also to station them, to manufacture them, et cetera, et cetera.
So the et ceteras are more than in the past, as I understand it. This treaty now is broader than in the past. Is that correct? Because these treaties and campaigns go back to the 1960s.
Yes, that's right. And it is the first treaty that comprehensively bans all these activities. Because before there were smaller treaties, for example, bilateral treaties on nuclear arms control or also nuclear disarmament. But on the international multilateral forum, there was mainly the NPT, which is the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And although there is an Article 6, that says that the current nuclear weapon states have to negotiate in good faith to disarm, they didn't do so yet. So that's where the ban treaty steps in and says, okay, we have to do something.
Yeah, I'd like you to just say a bit more to emphasize that point because often the rhetoric around this gets confusing. There's non-proliferation, there are limits on the types of nuclear weapons that may develop, but a ban is a different level of anti-nuclear activity, right? Say a bit more about these distinctions.
So on the current treaties, we have the non-proliferation. So basically to say that right now there are certain states that have nuclear weapons, but we don't want have any other states to have nuclear weapons. So that's proliferation or non-proliferation. And then we have arms control. I think many people would know the treaties from the Cold War era, where especially the US and the back then Soviet Union decided that they will not stockpile more weapons, for example. So they had these arms control treaties. And there were some disarmament treaties, so to actually reduce the number of nuclear weapons. But right now, with the TPNW, this new treaty, it's only now in January 3 years old. So with this new treaty, nuclear weapons are banned. So they are completely forbidden. And the goal of the treaty is a global zero in the end.
Abolishing them.
Exactly, abolishing them.
So, can you also, without listing the countries, the members, and those who are not members or observers, can you de describe the geographical demographics of members and where the greatest support and opposition lies?
Well, with the ban treaty, it's kind of obvious that all the members currently are non-nuclear weapon states. Most states are located in the so-called global south of the world. A lot of African states, Latin American states, also Asian states. Right now, there are 69 member states and I think 92 signatories. I'm not quite sure about the second. And the opponents are basically the global north, especially the NATO states, the nuclear weapon states. And there was the NATO states, of course, also nuclear sharing states like Germany, where I come from.
So, what is the strategy for taking on these powerful countries that possess nuclear weapons and are opposed to bans for obvious reasons? Or there perhaps are multiple reasons. There are five or six countries, and Israel makes six, right, that are nuclear powers. Can you list them?
So altogether, we have nine nuclear weapon states, I
Nine
think.
now.
Yeah, it's five official nuclear weapon states, like official under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The United States, it's Russia, France, Great Britain, China. Those are the so-called official nuclear weapon states. And then we have Israel, we have North Korea, we have Pakistan, and we have India. And of course, they're all not part of the Ban Treaty. Otherwise, they wouldn't be nuclear weapon states anymore. And the approach of the treaty to get these states on board, well, at the moment, it is quite hard, I have to admit. I think the main goal is to have as many states as possible within that treaty to actually say, okay, the majority of states, the majority of people in the world are against nuclear weapons and want them to be banned, want them to be abolished. So to raise the political pressure internationally on these states to actually do something about their arsenals. And also there are the so-called positive obligations of the Ban Treaty. That means victim assistance and environmental remediation. So to say, okay, we already have victims of nuclear weapons, and that's not only in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but worldwide by nuclear weapons tests, for example. And the treaty wants to raise support for these people. And I would say that's a really good pathway towards also regarding the nuclear weapon states, or probably not them, but at least their allies. So for example, Germany as an ally, as a nuclear sharing state, is observing these meetings, and they're actually engaging in victim assistance, or they're just about to start to do so, but so they recognize that nuclear weapons are harming people, are harming the environment. And I would say that's a good step towards to probably not get them on board for the treaty yet, but to have them on board to say, okay, there are actual humanitarian consequences and we have to deal with them right now at the moment.
Can you
And
list some of those and how nuclear weapons are a climate justice or environmental justice issue?
list of some of the test areas
Well,
or
how these particularly impact indigenous communities, certainly in the US and around the world. So I think often nuclear proliferation, like nuclear power, are separated off from other environmental issues or climate justice issues.
during the nuclear weapons tests, especially during the atmospheric tests, often portrayed as if those were so-called empty spaces. I think we saw that, for example, in the new Oppenheimer movie by Nolan. So they ride along this like New Mexico, this empty lands and nothing here. But actually there were people, and these people were harmed by nuclear weapons, not insofar as that they died because of the explosion, but of course of the radiation, because there was fallout in the area, but also in wider areas. And this caused medical consequences like cancer, for example, like miscarriages, like related mental health issues. There were higher suicide rates, for example, in the Soviet Union. They tested, for example, in Semipalatinsk, and the region had the highest suicide rate because of also other medical preconditions. Also because the land is completely contaminated. And for example, when we see the Marshall Islands or Kiribati, French Polynesia, other testing areas, people were really dependent on their own agriculture, for example, or on fishing. So with the radiation, the land got contaminated, the water got contaminated, so people couldn't use the traditional or couldn't continue with the traditional living anymore.
This is
Now,
an
I wonder.
ongoing issue.
Yeah, of course, that is ongoing because there was no so-called environmental remediation yet, so there was no cleanup whatsoever. So people are still facing this.
What is the extent of testing of nuclear weapons now versus in the past, where most of this, as I understand it, went underground? And so there are claims that the effects of testing, the health consequences, can be more controlled.
So I would say there are three stages. There were the atmospheric tests, and then they went underground. And underground, of course, it still polluted the area, and also, especially also on the atolls, so these islands where they tested, the material is really porous. I don't know, like it's really easy to break. So, especially on the islands where they tested, the underground is not made for this test. So the underground is contaminated at the moment, and there is a risk for it to break open because it was shaken and it's not solid enough to hold that.
Do participants at the meeting or organizations that support a nuclear weapons ban take up reparations around nuclear testing?
Yes, they do. The thing is that at the first meeting of state parties, as you mentioned, in 2022 in Vienna, they wrote the so-called Vienna Action Plan. And I would say this meeting right now was a little bit like a work in progress meeting to see where we are at the moment. And between these two meetings, there was the so-called intersessional process. So the states are not only meeting during these meetings, but also in between in working groups. And there is one that is especially designated to see how one can actually assist victims and the environment. And they plan, for example, on an international trust fund to assist people, but it's not set yet. So they're discussing the means and the instruments they want to implement. There is the hope that they will implement them on the next meeting, which would be in 2025. But of course, it's the state negotiations that take their time, and they have to see like how exactly one do we want to design this fund, who exactly can participate, how do we decide on distributing the money that gets in there. So they're talking about this at the moment.
Is that important in the organizing around Ban the Bomb, which goes far back to the 1950s? I remember as a child seeing Ban the Bomb posters and pins, and I think the campaigns around it and the strategies, including rhetorical strategies and political strategies, have changed over time. Do you think that's important, this part of the work that you're describing now, showing that it's not only whether or not nuclear weapons are used again after the horrors of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but that this is an ongoing destructive practice of militaries?
I would say yes, it is. I would not say probably that it's so completely new, because there was this Nevada semi-politics movement, that was also about the victims of nuclear testing in Nevada and in semi-politics in the Soviet Union. So I would say there are also roots of this in the like really long and old tradition of this movement. But I would say yes, it came up recently again. Also with the treaty having this positive obligations, well, right now that's my really like Western European German perspective, but I would say that it's a really good entry point, for example, for lobbying, because in Germany, especially at the moment, we have a lot of young members in the parliament. And so I was born after the Cold War, and many people are at the parliament as well at the moment. So for us, this fear of a nuclear war, it's probably not as present anymore as some older members
Right.
telling
You don't
you so
have
that it helps
the
you.
gut level shutter reaction.
Exactly,
Many of us did.
exactly.
You growing up and hiding under our school desk.
Exactly. And I mean, that's a good thing. I mean, I'm glad that I don't, but I think it changes the movement a little bit, right? And I would say that the survivor's perspective is really important in that part because my generation, we were brought up with these ideas of feminism, of post-colonialism. So we have these new ideas that were always kind of there in the movement, but I think we have a different perspective on them, or they're more important to us probably. And so when I talk to parliamentarians, I see that especially the younger ones are more interested in this nuclear survivors perspective and are like, oh, okay, I didn't know. That's something I hear. Like, I didn't know that there were these tests, that there are people affected. So you have another entry point, I would say. And I would say that's really important. And especially in countries like Germany, where we, due to so-called NATO obligations and the political pressure that is put on the government, on the parliamentarians, not to question nuclear sharing, not to question nuclear weapons. It is a point where you can say, okay, but even underneath this, even though we do not agree on that, can we talk about how to assist victims? Can we talk about how to help them with their environmental problems?
And the report that came out of the meeting also declares a commitment to women, the participation of women, and gender as an aspect of the work and the impacts of nuclear proliferation. Can you say a bit about that? How gender shaped even these more recent meetings?
And my really first initial thought was, yeah, I do see a lot of more women here, and I hear a lot of more women talking than I ever had on the NPTs, so the Non-Proliferation Treaty conferences. So I would say there are more women participating, more women are actually talking up. And so regarding the consequences and why it is a topic on the conferences is because radiation affects female bodies other than male bodies. And we don't know yet why. We know that women and especially girls are more likely to get cancer due to radiation, for example. And there is no or not enough research on the reasons for that. And the treaty wants to look into that because the assistance should also be adapted to gender, for example. And to like it differs between younger and older people, right, as well. So they really try to get into these dimensions as well.
Before we close, I also wanted to ask you to say a bit about the relationship between nuclear power, nuclear energy, and nuclear weapons, because, of course, nuclear power became the redemptive story in the US for justifying these horrific weapons and remains linked to the military and nuclear weapons. And I understand why these nine countries that possess nuclear weapons resist talking about or confronting that association. But how are you dealing with that with your organizations in Germany and elsewhere? The links between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Can you just say briefly?
I have to say that that's more like the IPPNW take on the issue and not of the State Parties Conference, because the Parties Conference is only nuclear weapons.
But
So
the
the IPPN.
international, just to repeat, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW, where you're a
Exactly.
member, that you can't speak for your organization on
Exactly,
that
exactly.
point.
And we are working on both topics because for us it is linked. And if we see, for example, the source of both, which is uranium mining, which already inflicts a lot of pollution, a lot of contamination, a lot of humanitarian consequences already. And if you have Fukushima, Chernobyl, so all the big accidents that we know about, Three Mile Island, there were huge consequences of this. So I would say nuclear power is never safe and it's always a danger, be it in nuclear power plants or in nuclear weapons. I mean, nuclear power plants were kind of a byproduct of nuclear weapons production. So there was first the military use and then the civil use. So it's just inherently connected to each other.
And we
In
see that
Germany,
in war zones now as well, where
exactly. In Zaporizhia, for example, we just like the states cannot agree on a demilitarized zone around Zaporizhia and Ukraine. So there is also danger of nuclear power plants in war zones, in conflict zones, exactly.
Well, Giuliani Hauschultz, how can we find out more about your work before we close today? Can you say a bit about how listeners can become more involved, and particularly as it is part of a broader anti-war movement or social justice, anti-colonial movements? How can we find out more about your work or other work you find meaningful?
I would say about my work, that would be on the website of the IPPNW, IPPNW.org, which is the international IPPNW, and there everything is in English. There's also an American section of IPPNW, and also ICANN. So that is ICANNW.org. That's the international website of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which is a huge campaign, and IPPNW is also part of this campaign. And I would say for people who are interested in the whole nuclear weapons topic, I would definitely recommend the website of ICANN.
Well, we'll in include some of those sites on our KBOO website on the Olmo Variety Hour. And once again, Giuliani Hauschultz, thank you so much for being with us today and for your important work. I hope to bring you on to the show again.
Thank you. That would be really nice. I would love to.